This is a special edition of the Crime Couch. It's in honour of former Victoria Police Sergeant Ron Fenton. Ron passed away on Tuesday, the 13th of April, 2021. He was buried with full police honours at the Police Academy. I was fortunate to do one of the last recorded interviews with Ron a month ago. He'd been diagnosed with terminal liver cancer, and despite his obvious pain, I was struck by Ron's incredible courage, positivity, and steely determination to make a real difference. This podcast is in your honour, Ron Fenton. Rest in peace. Hi, I'm Rochelle Jackson. Welcome to The Crime Couch. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author, and I know who's who in the zoo, the crims, the cops, and the interesting individuals in between. So get comfy and join me each week on The Crime Couch for a rollicking, intriguing tale. It'll be one heck of a journey. Ron Fenton was in Victoria Police for 40 years. He joined the job at 16 and was the youngest constable to work in the search and rescue squad. Then, on November the 21st, 1984, Ron and his partner, Senior Constable Paul Gilbert, responded to a job that would change their lives forever. In fact, it almost cost Ron his life. They were the first on the scene when gunman Kai Matty Cohornan, a former Army reservist, armed with a semi-automatic and 200 rounds, ambushed a security guard in a car, shooting him dead. Ron has a PhD in survival. He's been shot in the head, broken 37 bones in a motorbike accident, tried to take his own life several times, and been diagnosed twice with terminal cancer. I'm sitting with Ron on the crime couch in his lounge room on a rather grey and gloomy day. Hi, Ron. Thanks very much for sitting with me on the crime couch today.
Thanks, Rochelle. Good morning to you.
Tell me, why did you want to become a policeman, Ron?
I wanted to be a diver in the search and rescue squad. That was my primary concern of joining the police force. I'd been practicing quite funnily. I'd been studying with the hope of becoming a surgeon. And in fact, a brain surgeon was what I was aiming as my life. And then I saw a 60-minute special about the Victoria Police search and rescue. I'd been diving as a scuba diver for a couple of years by then. And the idea of having a job where I could dive being paid for it, that was it. And so I joined actually to be in the search and rescue squad. That was my original goal.
What did being a cop mean to you?
My family has always been one for service. My father, my grandfather, my mother were all in the various military forces. And I wanted to have a job where I could do something good. You know, not the weird and esoteric aspects that we do when we sit at recruiting panels. I actually wanted to go out there and have fun, have a job that was exciting, that was varied every day, no 2 days the same, and also be able to help people.
You and your partner, Ron, Senior Constable Paul Gilbert, responded to a call on the 21st of November 1984. You were the first on the scene. Now, what actually did you see? What unfolded in front of you?
Well, as we were driving down the road, we could see the car, Peter's car, parked on the driveway, and you could see a dark line running down the gutter from the car all the way down the gutter quite some distance, and became very obvious to us then that that was blood, and that the blood was all coming from the body that was sort of half sitting, half lying in the car. And walked up to the scene, saw that Peter was dead, obviously dead, there was that much blood lost, and then another current car unit turned up, and they took control of the scene, made sure everything was secure, and myself and Paul started going to visit all the security guards in the area, trying to get information of whether they'd heard anything, whether there were any strange vehicles in the area, if they'd heard the gunshots, etc., etc. And we were just basically doing a door-to-door with security guards.
And where had Cohonan gone? Had he done a runner?
Yeah, he'd disappeared from the murder scene. We found out later that we actually passed each other. He ended up travelling north along Springvale Road while we were travelling south. It was quite unusual. But he disappeared and eventually ended up down at Ricketts Point, Beach Road by Morris, which is where he got involved with my other mates, Peter and Graham, Peter Kieran and Graham Fletcher.
Now, police, as you said, tried to stop Kilhonen's car, but he blasted them with about 20 rounds.
Yeah.
What was going through your head as you drove to that scene? Did you respond knowing that it was going to be him?
Well, we didn't know. When Sandringham 311 was being shot, we knew there was problems, etc., and we had to get there, so we got there as quick as we could. And there was a fair, you know, it was pretty obvious that because of the distance and what was happening, the fact that there were rifle shots and we already dealt with a rifle, it was pretty obvious that we were going to the same offender who still had obviously the same high-powered weapon and was presenting a danger to my partners and to my mates. So, you know, the cavalry corps went out and off we went.
Ron, you went to a nearby park where the offender's abandoned car was. What happened then?
We're driving around. The whole idea was the cars were driving around the park because we had information, which turned out to be inaccurate. But we had the information that he had disappeared from Scott Street, which is where the initial incident took place, and he'd gone into Griffiths Reserve, which is a park on the edge of Tramway Parade. So the intention of all the police at that stage was to surround Griffiths Park and basically hold him in the area until the Men in Black, you know, SAG, turned up and they'd take over the scene. We were just literally to contain him. Unfortunately, in the 2 minutes, 23 seconds it took me to get from Clayton to Beaumaris, he'd managed to get out of the park, crossed the road, and he was on our left-hand side. We were thinking it was on our right, and unfortunately I became tunnel-visioned and didn't think about the fact that he could have crossed the road. So we're driving around the park, basically containing him. But at that stage, he got across the road and he was hiding behind a fence. Another unit had unfortunately identified us by driving around with their headlights on. We quite told them to turn the lights off, which attracted our attention to him, or our attention to us. And we're driving down the road and we're still moving when suddenly my car started to disintegrate. He stood up from behind the fence and put 27 rounds through my car. Turned it into Swiss cheese.
So you opened the car door and, of course, well, you would just open the car door and you were trying to run for cover. But
No, not at all. The whole thing was when he first hit us, it was the first wheel hit the passenger side tyre. Next round hit the passenger side headlight, then five across the bonnet into the engine bay, which is why the engine obviously died at that stage.
You basically couldn't use your car.
We had no tyre, no front tyre, no engine. We were trapped. So I was in a four on the floor Commodore. Still remember the Rego number. And Paul was literally leaning into the footwell over the gear knob. Which left me with the steering wheel in front of me. I had nowhere to go. I couldn't bend over because Paul was there. And I would have done exactly the same. You know, Paul did exactly the right thing. I would have done exactly the same options if I'd been there. So all I had the steering wheel in front of me. I had no way of getting below the sight line of Kai. So the only option to me was to put the car, the body of the engine, between me, myself, and I knew where the bullets were coming from. And had to put the car between us. But during that time, Kai, because of his training, had been watching his fall of shot and had seen where his bullets were landing. And so he managed to spot my head between the windscreen pillar and the door pillar as I was turning around to get out of the car. And that's why the bullet hit me in the back of the head. I wasn't running. I was just literally turning around to get out of the car. And the bullet hit me in the back of the head, and I had reason to lie down for a little while.
My goodness, Ron, that's a slight under exaggeration. Now, you were shot in the head.
Yep.
Were you expected to live, Ron? You were shot in the back of the head with a military-grade bullet. The car was riddled. Were you expected to live?
No. By the time I got to hospital, they'd been communicating my obs, and my pulse was something like 136 and erratic. My breathing was unequal, unreactive. My pupils were unequal, unreactive. My breathing was what they call chain stroke or death rattle. By the time my family got there, they told I had maybe 3 hours. But lucky enough, no one told me.
They believed you wouldn't make it to hospital, but you did. Mm. Your family was told that you wouldn't last 3 days, but you did. And then after 2 weeks in a coma, they said you wouldn't recover brain function, but you have. How on earth have you managed to beat all these odds, Ron?
Location of the shooting. I'm lucky that they shot me in the backside, because obviously that's my... Sorry, lucky you didn't shoot me in the backside, because that's obviously where my brains are.
But seriously, how on earth are you sitting here alive today with such diagnosis and all the experts saying that you were never going to make it?
Luck, good fortune. I don't know. Basically, my family brought me up with the attitude of never give up. No matter how bad it is, you can overcome it, or if you can't overcome it, you can compensate for it. And it was just a case of learning how to compensate. It took me a long time. It took me 12 years to finally get enough physical ability back. But I managed to get back on the street as an operational sergeant in one of the toughest areas in metropolitan Melbourne, and enjoyed another 18 years on the street as a sergeant. And I was just fortunate, that's all.
You're a very humble man. Look, you left hospital with more than 30 pieces of shrapnel. I'm assuming that was bullets and metal.
He'd home adapted the bullets prior to the incident. He'd spent time drilling and cross-filing the head of every single round he had, so that the rounds were basically dum-dums in the public understanding of it. The bullets exploded on impact. And so what happened was the bullet hit me and exploded inside my skull. It went through the skull and then exploded into 37 fragments, which went into every single quarter of my brain. But then again, I'm the only copper I know that rattles when I walk. So you've got to look at the bright side.
So once again, you walk out of hospital with more than 30 pieces of shrapnel in your skull. Did you expect to ever work as a police member ever again?
Yeah, there's no question on that. It was going to happen. It was going to take me, I originally said 12 months. It took me 12 years, but there was never any thought other than, I've got to go back to the street. That's my job. That's what I do. I'm a cop on the street. Nothing important. I'm just a street cop that does his job, and I've got to go back there and do it. It's the only job I'm only qualified for, but I loved it. I loved being a cop. I loved being on the street and dealing with the troops and dealing with the people and helping people. And there was no option. I had to go back no matter how long it took me.
So you taught yourself how to write and even how to shoot with your other less dominant hand, is that right?
Yeah, non-master hand, and how to fight and all that sort of thing, because you've got to be able to physically fight. I just learned compensating techniques and learned to shoot with my non-master hand.
Left the job in 2012, Ron, due to ill health. Now, how difficult was this time in your life?
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a terrible thing. It was probably the most traumatic period in my life, because you're trying to analyse whether the thoughts, processes you have, and whether the feelings you have are actually genuine feelings, or are they a result of the illness you have. And it's trying to work out what is reality, what is not, and how much can I put up with this, etc. The night terrors, the feelings of inadequacy, the feelings of insecurity, not being able to be around anything more than people you know and you can trust. It was a terrible period, and it's a terrible period for any policeman that has PTSD. But it's like the army, and also like ambulance men, etc. We all, guys in the emergency services and the military, are in a situation where the human brain is not equipped, built, or trained to see the things we see or to do the things we have to do. And it gets inside your brain, you know, in through the amygdala and all that sort of thing. I know the chemical process and all that sort of thing, but we see some horrific things, and yet the next day or 2 hours later, we've got to be back to standard normal and treat the next person as though the thing that you just saw didn't happen. And now I've got to treat this new member of the public as though everything's fine.
And go back home at night and eat fish fingers with your family or with your partner.
And not take the trauma home. And that's the hard thing, not take the trauma home. And my second son, you know, was with me right through his early years, and you know, he went through hell because I was mentally damaged. I didn't realise it because you're doing your best to survive, and you don't realise the harm you're doing to others by being a recluse, by sitting in a chair and just disappearing into your own world, because that's the only world where you feel safe.
But I think after you've witnessed extraordinarily difficult and traumatic scenes, you do the very best you can, don't you?
Yeah, you have to. It's the only option you have. You can either wrap yourself up in cotton wool and ask the world to feel sorry for you, and sympathy will last maybe 3 months, or you dust yourself off, get up, say, well, I've lost this, but I've got all this. I've still got something I can do, and make the best of the situation you're left with.
But then something very special happened for you, Ron, in the form of a rather large black Labrador. Brown Labrador, excuse me. Tell me a little bit about the brown Labrador in your life.
Through my association and my history, I was also in the Army Reserve for 30 years. And through my association with them, I was contacted by a group called Defence Community Dogs, DCD. Now, DCD is a organisation based at this stage in Bathurst. And basically what it is they take rescue dogs, or dogs that are destined for euthanasia. They take them to the, at this stage, Bathurst prison. And the dogs are trained by the prisoners, or by the inmates. I don't like to call them prisoners. Inmates is probably the nicest term. Trained by the boys. And they're trained by the boys to be post-traumatic stress disorder dogs, to assist veterans that have got post-traumatic stress disorder. And by coincidence, or by fortune, by mutual contact through Dave Evans, a mate of mine, the DCD contacted me and told me they had a dog for me. And they were wondering if I was interested in having him. I went up to DCD in Bathurst in 2017, met Yogi, fell in love with him instantly, and we have been together since that day, inseparable ever since.
Tell me, Ron, how has Yogi changed your life?
In every single conceivable way. I tried to commit suicide 5 times prior to getting Yogi, and that will never happen again. I mean, even recently when I was diagnosed with terminal cancer, the black dog would naturally jump down and start to try and convince you that suicide was the right thing to do. But Yogi basically jumped in front of him and said, buzz off, he's mine. And I contemplated suicide maybe for 3 seconds when I was diagnosed, and then I had Yogi. So he's changed my life. But even before that, from the very first day I got him, I used to be on 17 tablets a day for my PTSD and anxiety and depression, etc. Within 4 months, I'm off all my psychotropic medication. I just don't need it anymore because Yogi takes the place. And I used to suffer from 3 to 4 night terrors per week, where you'd only sleep for an hour and a half before you'd wake up screaming. But now with Yogi, Yogi detects if I'm about to have a night terror from my breathing pattern, and he'll get up off the bed or up on the bed, and he'll wake me up and interrupt the night terror. And after a night terror, I can actually go back to sleep, because after you have night terrors, you don't want to go back to sleep because you might have another one. But I've learned that with Yogi, I can literally just go back to sleep and they won't come back. So I'm not suffering from sleep deprivation anymore. I'm happy. And I've got someone that gives me unconditional love 24/7.
Yogi has literally saved your life, hasn't he?
Several times over. You know, suicide, the depression that preceded getting him, etc. he's let me have a life. Literally, he's given me a life. I mean, that's why he's the inspiration for Animal Therapies Limited ATL Award, the Yogi. He's an amazing creature that's almost human. In fact, he's more human than I am. And I love him to bits.
What's the future for you now, Ron? Because I know it's once again, though, I think Yogi's definitely had an influence in allowing you to kind of even think positively about that, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. Look, the situation is I have terminal cancer. They've run out of treatment options, so nothing can be done for me now. Unfortunately, the cancer is just going to grow within my body until such time as it kills me. But I'm at peace with that. I'm at peace with that because I've had an amazing life. I've met hundreds of amazing people that have supported me and helped me through my life. I've been blessed to experience some amazing things. I've dived in the sinkholes in Mount Gambier. I've walked the Kokoda track. I've prosecuted law at Duntroon. I've been in the SOG before there was an SOG. Search and Rescue used to be the SOG. I've had an amazing, spectacular life. I've filled it to the full. And Yogi's with me in my dying days because now it's just a case of how long it takes for the cancer to actually get me. But I have my companion that is always there and just looks at me with those beautiful eyes and lets me know, it's okay, Dad. So I'm at peace with, you know, I'm going for assisted dying and I'm at peace with it. I've had a great life. It's time to step down off the podium and let others have their amazing lives.
You're a true inspiration, Ron, and thank you very much. It's been a real honour and a privilege to listen to your story today, and thanks very much for sitting on the Crime Couch with me today.
Thanks for the invitation. Quite a comfortable seat you have here.
Thanks for joining me. I'm Rochelle Jackson, and I look forward to your company next time on the Crime Couch.